Welcome to the D Program, a desensitized look at sensationalized media. Here are your hosts, Angie and Sarah.
Hey, everybody. Happy Friday, and welcome to another edition of the D Program. You're just getting me today, so I hope we get along okay this week. Looking forward to another jam-packed show. We got a lot to talk about. Boy, there's a lot going on in the news, so we're anxious to get into all of that with you today. We'll miss Angie this week, but she'll be back next week, so you can look forward to that. Until then, let's just get right into it. There's just so much. It's been a fascinating week or two. I'll tell you what. I think we are seeing the unraveling of the COVID narrative. I think it's finally coming undone, one little thread at a time. And I tell you, as I watch this unfold, and we'll get to some of the stories that lead me to believe that here in a minute, but you know, just on a general note, you knew as they were building this narrative around COVID that it was built on a bunch of lies. We all knew that very early on. It was pretty apparent to those of us that were paying attention. It was like a house of cards, but each card was one new lie. And I can't help think that, you know, it's foolish men who build their houses upon the sand. So I think they have one big house of cards built on a sand foundation, and it's starting to crumble. So it'll be interesting to watch as this continues to progress, but they've got a lot of problems on their hands here and how they're going to deal with this. You know, it's election season coming up, so they've got to divorce themselves from this issue and fast, and that's going to be hard to do. I also wonder, you know, as we go through some of these stories that I'd like to highlight today, you can't help but start to wonder if they're going to be able to pull this off. I mean, they may have just created a monster that they aren't able to tame, kind of let the genie out of the bottle that they can't put back at this point. So we'll see how this works out for them. But before we get to all things COVID and vaccine related, which there's a lot to discuss with respect to that, I want to start with my first topic, which is a little bit different. It's more along the lines of the economy and inflation and these other things that are also affecting our life to a great degree. Kind of get put on the back burner sometimes, but are still important to be aware of as they affect us day to day. So the first thing I want to talk about today is actually the dust up between Rand Paul and Fauci. I don't know what round this is. It's got to be round 7, 8, 9 by now. They've gotten into it a time or two. But this latest one happened just the other day, and Rand Paul said something at the beginning of his comments that I want to talk about a little bit in a bit of a different way. So let's take a listen to what he had to say, and then we'll break it down a little bit.
Dr. Fauci, the idea that a government official like yourself would claim unilaterally to represent science, that any criticism of you would be considered a criticism of science itself, is quite dangerous. Central planning, whether it be of the economy or of science, is risky because of the fallibility of the planner. It would not be so catastrophic if the planner were simply one physician in Peoria, then the mistakes would only affect that physician's patients, the people who chose that physician. But when the planner is a government official like yourself who rules by mandate, the errors are compounded and become much more harmful.
So he's talking about central planning here, and he mentioned central planning of the economy as well as of science and how dangerous it can be. And he talked about the fallibility of the planner. I thought that was brilliant, well-spoken as usual from Rand, but I wanted to talk about central planning in general, not with respect to COVID right now. We'll definitely get into that later in the show, but central planning has been an issue that has affected the economy, obviously, to a great degree. And there's always debate on both sides of the aisle on this issue. You know, how much power should the federal government have? How much control over the economy? And of course, from somebody like Rand Paul, who has more of a libertarian bent, he argues that this is not wise. And I tend to agree with him for the reason he cites right there is that all humans make mistakes. And when you have one person making all the decisions for 300 million people, when they make a mistake, not if, but when, it's going to be a huge mistake. And that becomes a big problem. The other thing about central planning and the federal government having so much power over the economy, instead of letting more of a free market system prevail, is a concept I learned from the great and wise Milton Friedman, who I think is fantastic. He's written lots of books, one of which is called Free to Choose, which I believe should be required reading for anyone before they're allowed to graduate high school. It's that important of a book. But in that book, he describes money in a way that when I learned about it, just stuck with me so much. I thought it was such a neat way to describe it. And I wanted to share it with you today. So this comes from Milton Friedman. What he talks about is he talks about four ways to spend money. There's four ways to spend money. The first way is to spend your own money on yourself. This is the most effective and efficient way to spend money, because when you spend your own money on yourself, you're very careful about getting good value for your dollar. So you're worried about how much you're going to spend, but you're also worried about the quality of the product or service you're going to get. So you're taking a lot of care on both sides of the trade. You don't want to spend too much, but you want to get good value, and you're looking into both aspects carefully. That's when you spend your own money on yourself. The second way to spend money is when you spend your own money on someone else. For example, if you were to buy someone a birthday gift or a gift of any kind. In that case, you take extreme care in how much you spend. You usually set some sort of budget and you stick to it pretty carefully, but you're not as careful about the quality of product or service you get for that money. Yeah, you don't want to give your friends crap, but you're not going to spend nearly the amount of time going through reviews and looking into the quality as you would if you were purchasing it for yourself. So you're a little more focused on one side of the trade as opposed to the other. The third way to spend money is when you spend someone else's money on yourself. Imagine going out to lunch on your boss's expense account, for example. In that case, you would take care to get the best quality that money can buy. You'll probably order the lobster and the best wine that they have available, but you're not really careful about how much it costs. You're not too concerned about that. You're not worried if they're overcharging. It's not your money after all, but you are going to get good quality for the money. So at least in that case, you're focused on the other side of the trade, not both of them, but at least one of them. The fourth and final way to spend money is when you spend someone else's money on someone else, vis-a-vis the government. This is all the government does. They don't have any money of their own. They don't make any money, but they spend the taxpayers' money on other taxpayers. So they're spending someone else's money on someone else. And this is the most inefficient and dangerous way to spend money, because you're not really careful about either side of the trade. In this respect, you don't worry about how much something costs, and you don't worry about the value or of the product or service you're purchasing, which is why we see the government spend enormous, obscene amounts of money on these programs. You know, how much did Obamacare, just the website to create, how much did that cost? It was obscene. So, but it just doesn't matter, because it's not their money. It's somebody else's money. So this is the government, and this is why it's so dangerous to put them in charge of everything or anything, because they aren't efficient. They have no skin in the game. There's no incentive for them to be careful, even on at least one side of the transaction, let alone on either side. When you wonder why the government has a spending problem, which then requires printing a bunch of extra money, which then results in an inflated currency, which then results in higher prices, actually just a lower value of a dollar. It's because of the way they're spending money. They're spending other people's money on other people. So they don't really take care to try to preserve it or get high quality products or services. So it becomes a dangerous, vicious cycle, and spending is the problem. So anyway, I always think back to that example Milton Friedman gave. And again, if you're interested in learning a little bit more about that, I really would highly recommend the book Free to Choose by Milton Friedman. But yeah, that was just brought to mind as Rand began his comments to Fauci, which I encourage you all to listen to in full. Rand does a great job, as usual. So let's talk about Fauci a little more here while we're on the topic. We love talking about Fauci here, as you know. So what's going on with Fauci these days? Well, I'll tell you, there's quite a bit. Rand questioned him in that clip about some emails that were exchanged early on in this COVID nightmare when all signs were pointing to this being the result of a lab leak. Scientists up and down the spectrum quickly started to suspicion that this was a very good possibility that this is what happened, that it was leaked from a lab. And of course, given the fact that Fauci was funding that lab and involved in the research at that lab, this narrative could not see the light of day as far as Fauci's concerned. And we all had suspicions that he was covering up, but there were some emails that were released recently between Fauci and some other scientists who were discussing strategies to silence other scientists who were bringing this possibility to the light of day. And so that's what Rand was questioning Fauci about. The proof is coming out now that Fauci was covering, he was lying, which is no big surprise to us here. The other interesting thing that's come out recently with respect to Fauci is some information that Project Veritas has released just the other day. And this was quite stunning, actually. So what Project Veritas released was documents that were obtained from DARPA, the Department of Defense's research outfit. And in these documents, they described a 2018 Project Diffuse is a project that they were pitched by EcoHealth Alliance. Now, remember, I believe EcoHealth Alliance is part of Bill Gates's foundation. So EcoHealth Alliance pitched this idea to DARPA in 2018 and was seeking a grant proposal. What they wanted to do in this project was genetically engineer some bat coronaviruses. Imagine that. But the Department of Defense, the DARPA, rejected their proposal. And the reason they gave was that while they believed the technology was feasible, the project was just too dangerous. But it must not have been too dangerous for Fauci and his NIAID and NIH, because they went ahead and picked up the project and funded it. So that's what these documents reveal. The other startling information that came out of these documents from Project Veritas was that it was identified back in April of 2020 that ivermectin, quote, works throughout all phases of illness because it both inhibits viral replication and modulates the immune response. So there you go. They knew, I mean, I hate to just hammer this and beat this dead horse, but they knew ivermectin worked and they withheld it from sick people because apparently they're murderers. I mean, I don't know how else to say it, but if you're not angry about that, I'm trying to come to terms with all of this. When I had COVID a few months ago, it was very difficult to get a doctor to prescribe the medication. And then once I found a doctor willing to do it, it was nearly impossible to get a pharmacist to fill it. And for me, it's not that big of a deal. I probably would have done just fine without ivermectin. I believe that having taken it, it shortened the duration of the illness for me, which I'm grateful for, but I probably would have gotten over it just fine eventually. I don't think I would have been hospitalized or faced death from COVID, but there's so many other people that it could have helped. It could have saved so many people that died that didn't have to. One simple medication that's cheap and easily accessible, but it was withheld by these criminals, by these lunatics, and hundreds of thousands of people died that didn't have to because of them. And we can't let them get away with this, given the fact that they knew this. But it sure is a sad state of affairs that our doctors and medical professionals would have followed our government down this road. It was a dangerous road. And I think it did our medical professionals in this country a lot of harm with respect to their credibility. That's scary and dangerous. I mean, the government lost their credibility a long time ago. Nobody buys what the government sells anymore. It's at least many people have figured that out some time ago. But there was a sacrosanct relationship between a patient and their doctor, and there's a chink in that armor now, and it's going to be tough to get that trust back, at least for me. I don't know about the majority of Americans, but this has been really damaging. And the saddest part is, while we're talking about doctors, you know, I understand why doctors and pharmacists, I understand why they did it. There was a carrot and a stick. The government used both. They incentivized this fear They incentivized cases, and then they threatened to take licenses away from doctors if they prescribed ivermectin or anything that wasn't part of the narrative. So doctors were in a tough spot, no doubt about it. And so I understand, I don't give them a pass, because as men of science and as men who took an oath to do no harm, it saddens me that there are carrots and sticks big enough that they're even willing to turn on their own principles. The saddest part about the medical professionals in this country is that they did this for whatever reason, whatever their motivation is, because they wanted the carrot or they were afraid of the stick or a little bit of both. And they thought that that would save them. They thought that that would save them. But what happens when you get into bed with government is you often pick up the diseases that government spreads. A lot of times you're going to end up under the bus one way or another. And you can end up under there with your principles intact, or you can end up under there as a soulless psychopath who costs the lives of countless people. Those are your two choices. So while they used doctors as useful idiots, their use for doctors is now over. Just because you followed everything they told you to do doesn't mean you're going to be off the hook when the time comes to find the perfect scapegoat. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Brian Stelzer on CNN did a segment a few days ago on the 10th, I believe. And I want to play a little clip of this and what he has to say about doctors now.
Dr. McBride, doomsday doctors is an inflammatory term. I want to be careful about it, but I want to know what you're seeing firsthand. You treat patients, they come in, they ask you about COVID. What are you hearing? What are you seeing personally?
So as you just opened with, Brian, this is a parallel pandemic of mental health in crisis. You know, we are bathing in fear. People have been worried and panicked necessarily because of the threat of COVID-19, which is absolutely real and present. That said, those of us in the medical profession, particularly those of us who are patient-facing, who help people every day, understand their unique vulnerabilities for disease, whether it's from COVID or cancer. Yeah. We have an obligation to help people frame risk, to deliver fact-based, nuanced information. Fear does harm. It only makes people afraid. It doesn't affect people's decisions. So when I'm on Twitter or right now with you, I'm trying to help people understand that, look, your risk for COVID is as different as someone else's. And revving the emotional engines of people's anxiety only does harm.
What's a specific example of that kind of fear, that panic porn that you've seen recently?
Well, there are a lot of doctors who are talking about, you know, what if your child ends up in the ICU and then you die and from the same COVID infection and then you're, you know, parentless. That's just, in my opinion, not helpful.
These people have no shame, do they? These talking heads, media elite, how dare they? How dare they, really? But as a doctor who got in line, I hope you see what it's gotten you. You're a doomsday doctor now. You're a gloom and doom, panic porn, fear-mongering doctor who's not helping and who's doing harm by spreading fear and anxiety. Now listen, I know that's not true. I know it was these very people that are pointing the finger. I know it was the media. It was the government elite trying to pin this on Trump to ruin his chances at re-election. But you fell in line with it. You didn't speak up. You didn't stand up for health, for science, for your patients. You got in bed with this sick, twisted evil. And now they're turning on you. And now they're blaming you. I hope it was worth it. I hope it was worth it for you. The reason I'm so angry about this is because I expect this from the media, from the government. I often think of a comment my dad made to me one time many years ago. He says to me, everything the government tells you is a lie. And for some reason, that comment has been etched in my memory, one of those foundational memories I have. And I go back to and I think about it often. And the reason I think it sticks in my head isn't because what he said was so profound, even at that time, several years ago, maybe a decade by now, I already kind of knew that. So it wasn't revolutionary information he was sharing, but what struck me was the way he said it, just very casually, very nonchalant, just matter of fact. This is the way it is. Learn it, know it, get used to it, and brace for it and act accordingly. And so the fact that the government lies, that the media lies, this is not a shock to me and to most people, I suspect. But the doctors, the pharmacists, the medical professionals that swore an oath to do no harm, that hurts. That's scary. Because when you're sick and you need someone to go to help you or your family or child, you want to trust that the doctor is doing what's in your best interest as the patient. You want that trust. And many doctors have gone a long way to obliterate that trust. And you see what that's gotten you. Now, let me clarify that I don't by any means mean all doctors. Not at all. There are still some noble medical professionals that you can find that are practicing medicine that are doing the right thing. They're out there, no doubt about it. Absolutely. And I commend them because they've had to go through all of this and it wasn't easy for them. I'm not suggesting it was, but they seem to be the exception instead of the rule. And for the doctors that jumped in bed with this, that pushed vaccines, even though they knew we don't have enough information, I'm not suggesting that the vaccines are dangerous. I mean, I am suggesting that, but from a doctor's perspective, I can understand them not saying that, but we don't have enough data. At best, we don't have enough data. And when these first launched, we certainly didn't then, but many doctors just blindly followed the government without thinking for themselves, without using their years of knowledge they gained in medical school, without looking at the science themselves. And now these very people that they listened to, that they followed into the depths of hell, well, now they're turning on you. It's no shock to me. It shouldn't be a shock to you. And in the meantime, you sacrificed your principles, the trust you had with your patients. Maybe this is a good thing. Maybe this separates the wheat from the chaff. Maybe at the end of the day, when the dust settles, what we'll have left are the doctors who we can trust. Maybe this is just a culling that we needed. I don't know. Like I said, this was one of the saddest parts of the COVID pandemic for me, was the way the doctors acted. You know, I expect this kind of nonsense from government, from the media. That's not a shock or a surprise. But the fact that so many doctors fell in line so quickly was startling and scary for me. And it's sad to see that they did all of that for nothing, because now they're being used as the scapegoats. It's the doctors who are the doomsdayers. It's the doctors who are spreading fear. This from Brian Stelter, from CNN. This from CNN, blaming the doctors for spreading fear. It's rich, isn't it? They have no shame, these people. I mean, you can go back and you can look at what Stelter said over the course of this pandemic, what CNN has been pumping out for 2 years now. And now they blame the doctors for stoking fear. So there you have it. That's how it goes. Now, as we watch this narrative unfold, it will be interesting to see who they use as scapegoats. I'm really hopeful people start to look at Fauci very seriously here. I mean, and with some of the stuff coming out from Project Veritas, with his emails being released about squashing any dissenting voices from other scientists, I hope people start to wake up and say, wait a minute, let's take a closer look at Fauci's role in all of this. All right, so let's move on to some other examples of how the narrative is changing. We had a tweet from the CDC director, Walensky, the other day, which was basically a series of numbers with respect to your risk for COVID, specifically Omicron, and how Omicron is really not very dangerous to the vast majority of people, that it's much less chance of hospitalization than previous mutations. There's zero patients from Omicron on a ventilator. that your length of hospital stay for those that are hospitalized, the few that are hospitalized, is shorter. The symptoms are milder. Basically, a series of statements saying Omicron is just not that deadly. It's not deadly at all, not that dangerous to most people. So we're slowly shifting the narrative here. And we all know why, as I mentioned, we have an election coming up and this is a non-winning issue for the Democrats. So they're moving away from it at light speed. But what they've created here is, I mentioned they've created a monster. So if you look at some of the comments on Walensky's tweet, it's what you would expect after 2 years of injecting this kind of fear and mass formation psychosis into a population. You can't just flip a switch, I'm afraid, when you've created this kind of mass mental health problem, mental illness on a national scale. You don't just turn that off. Unfortunately, fear is a powerful emotion, the most powerful of all human emotions, without question. And I think that the government and the powers that be are about to find out just how powerful fear is. And they've released this monster on the public, and it's more powerful than even they are. So some of the comments that Walensky's tweet is getting are things like, well, what about all the immunocompromised people? Or we have to stop cases. And it just a bunch of still panic. I mean, just this gripped panic that people have been dealt. So it's going to be interesting to watch how they figure out a way to walk us all out of this mental crisis many of us are in. So people aren't going to let go of that fear easily. We'll have to see. I saw another tweet from a woman, and just an average person, citizen, but this is just another example of this mental illness that has gripped the nation. But she made a comment about how her son had contracted COVID and how upset her and her husband were at him for this. They've taken away his Xbox. They've quarantined him to his room, that they would even take away his phone, but that he needs it to text for food. But they were very angry at him. They were punishing him for contracting an airborne virus. They were angry with him and punishing him. This is a derangement. This is the psychosis. And of course, I'm sure you saw the headlines of the one mother whose son had contracted it. And again, I think about young teenager, and she put him in the trunk of her car to take him to the testing site. And this was a teacher. She was a teacher. I don't remember what state that was out of, but this is a problem that, again, I don't know how the government is going to walk this back. People have gone and lost their minds, and you can't come out with a few tweets and a few CNN segments and turn it all around. I mean, maybe you can. I don't know. I guess we'll watch and see what happens, but there's some sick people. There's a lot of very sick, ill people. And I go back and forth. I don't know if you do, but I go back and forth between being angry at these people and then having sympathy for them, because it's, you watch how they're acting and it's sad. It's really sad. And to see them levying it on their children in this way is just beyond reprehensible. So yeah, they're going to try to walk this back before the midterms. We'll see if that bears fruit for them. So let's move on a little bit, still COVID related, but I want to talk more specifically about the vaccines. Before I get into some of the specifics that we've learned over the course of the last week or so, I want to make a general statement about vaccine mandates. One of the arguments that the pro-mandate side has always had is that this isn't just about you, it's about other people. That yes, you have freedoms to do whatever you want with respect to yourself, but when it affects other people, then you have to do what we tell you to do, right? That was their argument. And that was always a tough one to overcome with a contagious virus like this, right? But the minute that the vaccines were shown that they do not stop transmission, which was some time ago, I mean, we knew this pretty early on in the vaccine rollout. The government knew this. Media has known this. This hasn't been a secret. They've, been pretty upfront that it doesn't stop transmission. It doesn't stop you from getting COVID. It doesn't stop you from spreading COVID. What they claim is that it stops you from getting a severe case, being hospitalized, and then dying of COVID. That's what they've been claiming now for some time. So the fact that this doesn't stop you from getting infected and this doesn't stop you from transmitting has been pretty common knowledge and accepted in the mainstream, accepted everywhere. But the minute that that was made clear and accepted narrative, the pro-mandate argument lost all its credibility at that point. I mean, that was the only argument they had that made any sense. But if it doesn't stop transmission, now a vaccine mandate is irrelevant. It's unnecessary because we don't really pass laws to stop people from taking risks on their own that only are a risk to themselves. People are allowed to drink alcohol. People are allowed to do all sorts of risky things. Let's go skydiving. I guess I don't know how risky that is, but people are allowed to take whatever risks they want as long as it's only a risk to themselves. Now, some people might throw in here the seatbelt argument. We mandate seatbelts. That is true. Also, it's a very stupid law and we should repeal it for this very reason. I'm a big advocate for seatbelts. I think everyone should wear them. I think wearing a seatbelt is very wise. But passing a law mandating it is not wise. It's stupid. And it's a slippery slope that lands us to vaccine mandates. Because if you can pass a law to protect somebody from themselves, then there's no law you can't pass. You could pass a law that mandates everybody exercise 30 minutes every day. You can pass a law that nobody's allowed to eat French fries anymore because it's bad for their health. That becomes an endless road to totalitarian, a police state. I mean, an endless road to right here, to where we are right now. You have to take a vaccine, even though it doesn't protect anyone else. It doesn't stop you from transmitting to anyone else. It just protects you from getting really sick. Well, what if I don't care if I get really sick? What if that's my choice to take on that risk? Do we have no choice anymore? I guess what's bothered me about this is that since we've known that the vaccine doesn't stop transmission, I haven't heard anybody really articulate this. So it concerns me that we're still even having this debate about vaccine mandates when they don't protect anybody other than the individual, and that individual can make that choice if they want to be protected. That's what living in a free society is all about. If somebody wants to take a risk that is a risk to no one else but themselves, there should be no law stopping them from doing that. But here we are, we have a vaccine mandate laws, two different ones that are still at the Supreme Court. I don't know what's taken them so long. Well, as I am recording, I am seeing coming across some headlines that the Supreme Court has actually finally come out with a decision regarding the two cases that were before them. And it looks like they've decided to basically split the baby here. They have ruled against the OSHA mandate, which is fantastic news. That was the most egregious one that required every employer with more than 100 employees to require vaccination of all their workers. That the Supreme Court has struck down. So that is fantastic. That is a good constitutional position to take. Unfortunately, with respect to the CMS, the healthcare workers, they upheld that one. They are going to continue to allow that mandate on healthcare workers to stand. This is just coming out now. I'm just reading it now. So it's going to take some time to maybe process this and go through what this actually means. But my initial feeling is that this is a really, really bad precedent. And it's a sad day for America, for freedom. We've talked at length about the vaccines not stopping transmission. So if you're vaccinated, you can still get COVID and you can still transmit it to your patients. So if they're doing this because they think it will protect the vulnerable patients in the hospital, they're setting themselves up for a false sense of security, for starters, not to mention the trampling on freedoms of the healthcare workers, their rights. So that one is certainly problematic and is bad precedent, I'm afraid. So we'll have to watch and see what the reaction to this will be, but it's hard. I mean, it's good and bad news here, isn't it? Kind of splitting the baby, but we'll see how this unfolds and how this is implemented. We can hope that even if they have the right, according to the Supreme Court, to do this, that at a certain point, they will pull back. I mean, they're already complaining about staffing shortages. So at a certain point, if you can't find anyone willing to work in your hospitals because of your egregious mandates, perhaps that might inspire them to do the right thing, even where the court hasn't. But we'll definitely keep an eye on how this unfolds. But if you had a chance to listen to any of the arguments made to the Supreme Court, some of the questions that the justices had just didn't make any sense. First of all, they were blatantly inaccurate, just false on their face, which you would think that a Supreme Court justice of the United States of America would have the most accurate and up-to-date information. I don't know if they're willfully ignorant. I don't know what's going on, but why they don't have the correct information is a little bit disturbing. But the other thing that disturbed me about it was that they seem to be getting down in the weeds as to the efficacy of the vaccines, the number of people that have died or that are sick or kids or this or that. The point is can the federal government mandate this? Is this within the Constitution? That's what they should be debating and discussing, not medical points about medicines. And that's not their role. That's for the doctors to debate. They're just supposed to debate the constitutionality of this. And to me, that's pretty clear. That's pretty clear. We've never had the federal government mandate things like this. This is not a Pandora's box we want to open. This is not a precedent we want to set. That's for sure. But let's talk about the vaccines. We're not Supreme Court justices. We're concerned with lots of aspects of this, the constitutionality of it, but also is it good medicine? So let's look and see what we're learning about these vaccines in the recent weeks. The first study I want to talk about today with respect to vaccines is a preprint of a study. Just to summarize very briefly, they looked at 145 different countries. They compared their vaccination rates to their death rates and their cases I don't know if they did hospitalizations or not, but what they found basically was a negative efficacy among the vaccines, which means according to this study, and I'm just the messenger here, I'm just telling you what this study is suggesting at this point, is that the more vaccinated a country is, the more deaths they have. That not only do the vaccines not work, but they seem to be making things worse. Many highly vaccinated countries are seeing record level COVID cases. And you might surmise that the vaccines have failed, but data from several of these countries is showing something much worse than that. It's showing that infection rates are higher in vaccinated people. Infection rates are higher in vaccinated people. So it's not good news for the vaccines coming out. And this is what's upsetting about the mandates. And what's interesting is even their tone on the vaccines, at least with respect to all these boosters they want to come out with, even the government officials, their tones on these boosters is starting to shift, which is really big news. You had the EU, I think, was the first one. The European Union was the first one to come out and say basically that we can't give boosters in perpetuity, that too many boosters could weaken the immune system, is what they said. This is the EU. And the World Health Organization followed suit, saying basically the same thing. And I believe even the FDA had made comments. Even back in September, October, the FDA was not suggesting everybody get a booster. They were talking very cautiously about boosters. They should be limited to those that are in high risk groups. The boosters are not appropriate for everyone for wide use. But yet everybody rushes out to get boosters because they're just so gripped with fear. And it's this fear that's driving them, not facts or data. And that's a frightening thing because as we're seeing in so many countries, just endless boosters is not going to be the answer here. In fact, it could be a problem, a big problem, as it could weaken immune systems and lengthen the duration of this pandemic. You know, you know that your elected officials, your leadership have completely lost their mind when the new policy is to fire healthcare workers because they don't want to take the vaccine, which is showing negative efficacy, by the way. but then you require COVID positive hospital staff to work with patients because you're so short staffed, because you fired non-vaccinated who aren't sick, but you won't let them work. Instead, you force sick COVID positive health professionals to work with patients. This is how sick and twisted our policies are. There's just no logical explanation for that, except that we're dealing with widespread mental illness. That's what we should be focusing on, mental health recovery. This has nothing to do with COVID anymore. This is a mental health crisis to a degree I don't think, certainly in a generation, we've never seen anything like this. That's what we all need help with, not with COVID. There is some other promising news. I learned over the course of the week that I believe it was the NCAA has decided to allow non-vaccinated players, so long as they have had COVID and recovered within the last 90 days. So they are starting to recognize natural immunity, which is some progress, I guess, very slow progress. I think they're still pushing the vaccines and really leaning on the players to get vaccinated. But according to the headlines, their policy is going to shift to allow non-vaccinated players to play so long as they have recovered from COVID within 90 days, which on its face sounds like good news heading in the right direction. But here's a policy that, again, I think you got to look at the unintended consequences sometimes. And I wonder, now 90 days, that gets them through the season, I believe. But what's it going to be next year? If you're only allowing players 90 days after they recovered, and then what? You kick them out if they don't take the vaccine at that point. But is there a potential with a policy like that to encourage people to intentionally try to become infected with COVID right before the season so that you have that 90-day window? You have to look at how people might work around the system here, and if that's really in the benefit of the players and in their health. The health of the players, and when we are learning now that these younger kids just aren't at risk, and the media is finally starting to admit that, something we've known all along. We've been screaming from the rooftops, let our kids be kids, let our college kids experience college. They get one shot at this, one chance in their lifetime to go through these experiences that are just so foundational and important for their mental, psychological, and physical well-being and their future. Let them experience these things. So there's other considerations besides whether they get a cold for a week. Sometimes that might be worth it to continue to experience the 4 years of college, the playing collegiate level athletics, or getting a high school graduation, or these other experiences that are pivotal in their life. So anyway, we'll see what happens with the NCAA rule there, if they really enforce that and how that's going to work. So, okay, the last thing I want to mention today, I think we'll probably have a little bit of shorter show than usual without Angie here, but that's all right. But I do want to mention one other thing as we watch this narrative start to unravel. We saw again, Dr. Walensky, the director for the CDC. So she came out the other day and she said, this is a doozy. Hang on to your hats on this one, kids. 75% of people who died of COVID-19 had at least 4 comorbidities. 75% had at least 4 comorbidities, which means these people were very, very sick, very ill, and were likely, many of them, probably going to die within the year anyway. I don't mean to sound insensitive. Death is a fact of life. It's coming for all of us. Many of these people are very old and very sick. Again, this is information that we all knew. We all knew. So it's not shocking when we hear it. It's more maddening and frustrating when we hear it, because they're coming out and they're telling us this as if they're telling us new information. And then she goes on to say that this is encouraging news. Right, but it's not news. It's just newly revealed. So if it's encouraging now, think of how encouraging it could have been 2 years ago, instead of putting us through the last 2 years of hell. So we could have used that encouragement some time ago. But what I'd like to see, and I haven't seen it yet, and I think it would be the most telling statistic of all. Maybe it's out there. Maybe I've just missed it. I'm not saying that they're hiding it, although that wouldn't put it past them. But I really would like to see all cause death for 2018 through 2021, get some comparative numbers, see how big of a spike we had in 2020 and 2021 of just all cause mortality. I think that might tell us a lot about how many of these people were probably going just normal people that die during the year because of all these other conditions that they die of. I'd like to see those numbers. If somebody has seen those numbers or has them, could forward them to us, email them to us, I'd really like to see them. I've been keeping my eye out. I haven't gone out and searched for them specifically, but I'm always keeping my eye out for them and I haven't seen them come across anything. But I think that would tell us a lot, the all-cause mortality through like 2015 through 2021, just to get some historical context on what that average is and how it compares to the last couple years. But yeah, again, so 75%, when we mentioned this early on that, listen, let's not panic here. Let's not shut our children's lives off entirely. Let's wait. It seems to be affecting older people more. We were grandma killers. We were terrible people. We were insensitive because we didn't want to sacrifice our children. It's 1,000% increased likelihood of a bad outcome from COVID. 1,000% greater chance if you're over 75 than if you're under, I forget the number exactly, 18 or 25, but 1,000 times difference. That's unusual in an illness, but that's important to know, because if you understand that information, then your policies should reflect that understanding. And the policies didn't. They were blanket policies. They treated everyone the same, even though the risk to COVID was vastly different for different people. Vastly, not a little bit different, not a lot different, vastly different. To the scale of 1,000 times. So the fact that we treated young people the same way we treated elderly as far as mitigating their risk is unconscionable, because not only was it unnecessary, but the damage that those mitigations have on young people compared to elderly is much different too. So it's upsetting and it's frustrating to see them coming out now saying all the things we've been hammering as if it's some new revelation, and they knew it wasn't. They're just walking it back now because we have an election. But I hope the voters are smarter than that. I believe that they are. I hope they have an attention span that lasts longer than 5 minutes, because that's all it would take to recall what they've done to us over the last couple of years. So we can just hold tight till we get to 2022. But in the meantime, it'll be interesting, like I said, to watch how they are going to weasel their way out of this. The one thing I am hopeful for is that as they walk this back, see, for me, that's not good enough. I mean, I want COVID to come to an end, no doubt, as most people do, I imagine. Not just COVID, of course, although that too, but just all this craziness, the mitigations, the policies, the mandates, whether COVID goes away or not, these policies need to end. People need to live their lives. Young people need to get on with their lives. They've lost enough already. So I want to see all of that end for sure. And COVID too, while we're at it. But even if all of that does end, for me, it's just not good enough. It's just not good enough. I want people to be held accountable for this. This was the greatest travesty, certainly in my lifetime. Easily in my lifetime. I want somebody to pay for this. I want people to be held accountable for a couple of different reasons. I mean, I think there needs to be accountability because, number one, these were serious crimes that were committed. The lies, the deceit, the unlawful mandates and infringements on our liberties, those all need to be held to account, people that participated in that. But then it also, there needs to be an example made for people to know that this can never happen again. We tried to do that at Nuremberg. We tried to make an example at Nuremberg, and it worked for a while, but apparently we need a Nuremberg 2.0, I guess. I don't know. At least go through the trials, because somebody needs to be held to account. Some questions need to be answered. And we can't let anything like this happen again. This was too devastating. Anyway, as they continue to try to backpedal and step all over themselves in the meantime, we'll have to watch who's going to end up taking the fall for this, who they're going to throw under the bus, because they'll always need a scapegoat. In the meantime, let's get on to our good news topic for today. The good news story I wanted to talk about was the truck drivers. You know, we've talked a lot about truck drivers lately as far as their role in the supply chain issues and how hard they work and how important they are to our society and how great of a job they do. Well, this is just another example of the spirit of the truck driver. So as most of you are probably aware, in Virginia, about a week ago now, I guess, they had this massive traffic jam on I-95 due to, I think there were some flipped trucks and there was some weather, some snow and ice was making emergency vehicles have difficulty getting to these accidents and getting them removed. And so people were just piled up on I-95 and they were stranded there for hours and hours and hours, overnight in some cases. We're talking 9, 10, 12 hours long. They're stuck in their car. Some of them ran out of gas. It was cold. Thankfully, I think there were no reports of any deaths. I don't know about injuries, but nobody died. But they were miserably uncomfortable for a significant period of time. It did not sound pleasant at all. One woman told her story of being trapped in her car with her two kids. She had run out of gas. It was cold. They were getting cold. And thankfully, a paramedic from an ambulance came to her window and took her and her kids to his ambulance to stay warm. So there were lots of stories like that to come out of that situation. But one of them is of this trucker who went around and shared hot breakfast with some of the drivers near him in their cars. You know, truck drivers have these cabs, of course, that have microwaves and food and water, and they're set. They're ready to set up in their cab for extended periods of time. So they're pretty comfortable, all things considered. But of course, the drivers in the cars around him didn't have the conveniences that he had. So he was heating up all of the food in his truck that he had, the breakfast sandwiches and coffees and waters, and he was handing them out to the drivers around him, which is just a sweet, feel good, heartwarming story. And it reminds you that, you know, when the chips are down, at the end of the day, we're all human beings. We all love our children. We all want what's best for each other in the long run, for ourselves, for our families. We're all doing the best we can. And when there's another human being suffering and struggling, it's in most people's nature to try to help. And this guy did a great job of that. So his name was Giancarlo Gaucher. So great guy, handing out food. Kudos to him. Thanks for being a truck driver. Thanks for being a good human being. Okay, so we're going to wrap up the show here today with some quotes. I have two quotes today, which is, I guess, appropriate since Angie isn't here, but they're both by Milton Friedman. I, of course, mentioned him earlier in the show. I'm a big fan of his, and he's really brilliant and has a lot of great quotes. So I have a couple of quotes from him today. The first one is about equality and freedom, generally speaking. So he says, "A society that puts equality before freedom will get neither. A society that puts freedom before equality will get a high degree of both." So it's similar to, I think it was Franklin's quote about sacrificing freedom for security. This is kind of in that same vein. Just the importance of freedom. We think about safety being so important, and what good is freedom if we're not safe, if we're not alive, if we're not healthy? The problem is without freedom, we soon won't be alive. We soon won't be safe. We soon won't be healthy. So it may seem on a short term a good trade, but in the long run, it's really, really not a good trade to trade freedom for anything. And the same can be said for equality. So as Milton Friedman points out. So the next quote I want to read from Friedman is about, this is a great one. This is one of my favorites from him. It's about intentions versus results. And he says, "One of the great mistakes is to judge policies and programs by their intentions rather than their results." So you could point to any government program. They're always good intentioned. In fact, the better intentioned they are, the worse they do generally. The vaccines, for example, it's such a good idea. We want them to work. Well, that's great, but we can't judge them on what we want or what our intentions with them are. We have to judge them on the results. We have to look at the data and we have to say, are they actually working? I know we want them to work. I know that was our intention when creating them, but are they working? And then we make judgments. We don't just pass mandates and force people to do things because we would just really want them to work. So anyway, I think those are great quotes from Milton Friedman. You should check them out. So with that, I guess we will end the show today. Sorry, it's a little chaotic of a show without Angie, but I did my best to get through some topics. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you come back every Friday for more of the D program. Angie should be back with us by next week. So we look forward to that. Until then, make sure you follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Gab. You can email us at the.dprogram@protonmail.com and check out our website, www.thedprogram.net. We hope you have a great week. Until next time.
Cheers.